Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello everyone, and welcome to the History of Byzantium. Episode 86, The Byzantine Republic, with Anthony Koldelis. Today, we have a fascinating interview with Professor Anthony Koldelis, the author of the book, The Byzantine Republic. Now, Professor Koldelis is someone I've quoted on the podcast before. It was his book, Hellenism in Byzantium, that was a major source for episode 41, Who is a Byzantine? And it was that book that gave us the great story of the child in 1904 saying, "We are Romans," to the Greek soldier. Professor Koldelis works at Ohio State University and has translated numerous Byzantine texts. The Byzantine Republic, as you might be able to tell from the title, is making the case for the survival, into Byzantine times, of something of the Roman Republican past. Now, I'm leaving that deliberately vague because you need to listen to the whole interview to get the full context of what he's arguing. I think you will enjoy this a lot. It is a long interview, about an hour and 10 minutes, but you'll get a lot from it. Before we begin, let me just add a couple of things for context. Professor Koldelis has Greek ancestry and was in Athens at the time of recording, and it was a few days before the Greek referendum back in July 2015 on whether to accept bailout terms being offered by the European Central Bank. The book was published back in February 2015, but while the book was being written, the events of the Arab Spring of 2011 were fresh in his mind, so that may help explain why those events are used to make comparisons with Byzantium. Also in the interview, there is reference made to the slaughter of a Gothic army on the streets of Constantinople around 399-400 AD. Those events are described in my typical style in the John Chrysostom episodes that you can buy from the website. Finally, I will be doing a brief follow-up episode to discuss some of the things brought up in this interview, but my analysis cannot match up to the value you'll get if you buy the book. Here's the interview. Professor Koldelis, welcome to the History of Byzantium.
Thank you, Robin, for inviting me on, and let me also thank you on behalf of my field for doing something that some of us should have had the good sense to do a long time ago. As you can imagine, we are very much trapped in the modes of communicating, more or less medieval modes of communicating, lecturing and writing. So when we think of reaching out to the public, we think of writing a shorter book on Byzantium. And so I think that you are doing us all an incredible service. So,
well, thank you so much for those kind words and coming on the podcast. We're here to talk about the ideas in your book, The Byzantine Republic. So let me start by asking, what led you to write this book?
Well, I suppose a growing frustration with the gap between the Byzantium that I see in the historical sources and the way in which it's represented in modern reconstructions. And that gap I can sort of summarize by pointing out the following kinds of contrasts or paradoxes that we observe when we look at Byzantine history. Actually, they're the sorts of things that anyone really notices in reading narratives of Byzantine history, precisely the kinds of narratives that you're presenting to your audience. But we find ways of normalizing them and making them seem okay when, in fact, we need to sort of highlight them and notice how peculiar Byzantium was as a political culture. So, for example, let's notice some peculiarities of the Byzantine political system. For example, that this is a monarchy that was fairly stable for a very long time, let's say 1,500 years, and yet the system of the monarchical system of Byzantium remained stable throughout a very, very large number of rebellions and plots and civil wars. It seems that the Byzantines are fighting a civil war every few years. And so we have a situation where perpetual civil wars or constant civil wars are not actually changing the political system that much. When it changes, it's not normally because of that. There's no one who wants to change the nature of the political system. And yet the emperor is always in danger, is always vulnerable to being overthrown. And so that is a strange kind of paradox if you think about it. In modern history, revolutions and civil wars tend to lead to some kind of fundamental change in the way the system operates, but not in Byzantium. It's also in striking contrast to Western monarchical regimes, which tend to be much more stable dynastically, right? So there are kind of rules that evolve for the succession. But in Byzantium, they never had those, just as they never did in ancient Rome. And so that's also a kind of perplexing feature of the political system. How did anybody cope with the idea of the succession at any time? How certain were you that there would be a stable succession? Okay, so that's one set of paradoxes. The other is more, let's say, ideological. That is, there's a contrast between the way in which we represent Byzantine political ideology and the realities of Byzantine political history. So the ideology we present as being very, very stable, it can be summarized and quoted and repeated and recycled very formulaically, like the emperor is appointed or crowned by God, and the legitimacy of the regime is grounded in its a theocracy of power, and we have all of these texts which explain the close relationship of the emperor and God and so forth. And in other words, we have a political ideology that is rooted in very absolute principles. And yet on the other hand, we have a very turbulent and almost chaotic at times, very dangerous and sort of disloyal political culture, where emperors are afraid of threats and plots and coups and rebellions and uprisings, and they're afraid of these because they happen all the time. So how can we use our reconstruction of the political ideology to explain political practice? And it just doesn't seem to me that we've been able to bridge that gap. So that's the problem that I have been wrestling with for a long time. How does the rhetoric, which is all about piety and loyalty and submission and authority, interface with the reality, which is much more, turbulent. I might even use the word dynamic if we want to sort of prettify it a little bit. So that was a problem. There seemed to be a missing middle ground. And the result is that in many narratives, in modern narratives, we have the setup, and the setup is, quotes the ideology, and this is what the Byzantines thought imperial power was. And then we jump to the narrative, and we don't really hear about that ideology anymore, and it just seems to be kind of pure power games and power politics with people maneuvering all the time. And I've always wondered, what was the context in which they were maneuvering? What did they think they were doing when they were plotting to overthrow the emperor or his dynasty, if it was not that ideology? And it couldn't have been. So that was a set of questions that have troubled me about Byzantium since I first encountered it.
Absolutely. And I think listeners will remember stories which highlight what you're talking about. I mean, the wider public may not have known, but when Justin, as in Justinian's uncle, comes to power, he's clearly not thought of by anyone who's pushing for him as chosen by God or a special man in any way. He's chosen as a sort of compromise candidate. So when you look at that, and we hear all the time that this idea of the emperor as the God's vice regent on earth, when you examined that and you wrote the book, what did you find about the emperor's position in society? What did you come to understand as the reality of how people saw his role and how he really earned and kept power versus that idea that he was appointed by God?
Well, that idea is very important, and I don't mean to underestimate its political role in legitimating the imperial regime. So it's once you become emperor, that is the role that you are expected to play. There are significant sort of theological and religious expectations placed on the office, and many of which actually can be read in political, social, and military terms. The emperor has a responsibility to defend the empire, but also to uphold orthodoxy as that is understood through whatever social, ecclesiastical mechanisms exist at the time. So that's very much the case. But the question is, how do you get to be appointed emperor, and what does that mean? So there is no coronation moment where a private citizen becomes an emperor. So how does that role come to you? And this is where I began to look at the process by which emperors are made. And actually, in the podcast that you have already made, especially the ones relating to the 5th century, we can see something resembling a transition in the way in which emperors are appointed. And so specifically, as your audience will recall, in the 4th and the early 5th centuries, emperors are largely created by the army. If an emperor wants to appoint his brother or his son as a co-emperor or as an heir, he normally does that through the army. By the end of the 5th century, we have the following situation. Well, there is no Western emperor anymore. And the Eastern emperor is now acclaimed not so much by the army, but by a combination of elements in the capital, that is Constantinople. So we have a very detailed description of the election, appointments, and acclamation of the Emperor Anastasius on the death of Zeno. So this is in 491. That is the most detailed account that we have in the entire millennium of the making of a Byzantine emperor. It's quite fascinating. It is found in the Book of Ceremonies. This is a 10th century collection, but it's a 6th century description. And it's recently been translated in the Australian series. And I recommend it to anyone who wants to see how all the different steps of creating an emperor. And basically what it involves is and we see this throughout the 5th century, a gradual transference of the appointment mechanism from the army to the people of Constantinople. And that remained the case more or less throughout the Byzantine millennium. And so my book focuses on the period after that transition has taken place. In other words, after the emperors have settled down in Constantinople and where imperial legitimacy, that is the process by which you acquire the role of an emperor and all of the theocratic sort of baggage, ideology, expectations that go with that role, that role is conferred at large popular assemblies. And I began to realize that those popular assemblies were not merely used to for this purpose, that is, for the appointment and acclamation of an emperor, but for other kinds of things as well. You are covering the reign of Constantine V now, and you probably noticed how he tended to use assemblies in the Hippodrome for propaganda purposes. In other words, he would assemble the people in the Hippodrome to present his agenda, possibly including the punishment of officials who deviated from his policy, and for basically drumming up popular support. And emperors tended to use this mechanism throughout the history of the empire, really. It was used for appointing heirs, and I can actually mention a striking event toward the end of the 12th century, which is so oddly reminiscent of what is going on right now in Greece, where I happen to be at the moment. So I am in Athens in early July 2015 for future reference. We're approaching the referendum on whether to to accept or reject the loan agreement. Anyway, in 1197, the German Emperor Henry VI was basically threatening Byzantium with an invasion, but promised not to attack if he were paid. He asked, I think, for 5,000 pounds of gold. The Byzantine Emperor Alexius III worked him down to 1,600 in a negotiation, if you will. And the emperor then had to put this, or chose to put this, before the people of the city in the Hippodrome, presumably. And there was a mass assembly. So it was basically a popular referendum. And it was called, believe it or not, the German tax. And so the Emperor of Byzantium was asking the population whether to approve or not the German tax to pay off the Germans. And the public sentiment was so overwhelmingly against it. And they started probably to boo and, what. And the emperor quickly backed off from this, and he started to pretend that it wasn't his idea in the first place, and don't worry about it, I'll find the money somewhere else. So it's an interesting example of how policies needed to be legitimated through some sort of popular consensus. Now, of course, these kinds of events are orchestrated and manipulated in advance in all kinds of ways, just as they are today. But what I found was a sort of pattern of the popular ratification of imperial or elite decisions, sometimes even the populace taking the matters into its own hands. And so from that point on, I began to think more seriously about the political role, and by extension, the ideological role that was played by the populace of Constantinople primarily in the creation, maintenance, and legitimacy of imperial power.
Well, can we talk more about that then? Can you give us examples? Because I imagine, a skeptical listener might think, well, if even a divine monarch raises taxes to unbearable levels or persecutes the people, they might end up rebelling. But can you explain that there's the more dynamic interactions and the ways in which the people thought of and expressed themselves toward the emperor that diverts from perhaps what we today might think of the more cordial, formal, fearful relationship between the people and the emperor?
Well, I think that all those different types of interactions and relationships existed, but at different times, and different emperors had different relationships with their subjects, at different times. What I was looking for more was the ideological substratum that made all of this possible in the first place. But yeah, sure, I can give you some examples. You see these. Well, first of all, let's talk a little bit about how emperors and subjects actually interacted. because there were different ways in which this could be done. An emperor, for instance, could send out instructions or orders or laws through his subordinates. They would be posted, read aloud. We know already from the period that you covered that subjects could sometimes react to these very negatively if they were unpopular. So all the troubles that Julian experienced in Antioch, for instance, but many other emperors. So sometimes they would post counter notices, post inflammatory or satirical poems about emperors. Sometimes they would chant these in public. Now, here is the risk that every emperor ran, right? So you could isolate yourself in the palace and not have direct contact with the people. Presumably this was a safer policy because personal interactions were risky. When an emperor appeared before the people, as inevitably he had to on some occasion, for instance, the races in the hippodrome or in church, there was the risk that if the situation was tense, if something was going wrong in the governance of the empire, this could be any number of things. It could be an unpopular religious policy or personnel decision about patriarchs or bishops. It could be a foreign war that was not going well. It could be a tax that was unpopular, unlike all the other popular ones. Those kinds of problems could create a tense situation that could result in, down to earth, booing, vulgarity, slogans, chanting. Okay, I suspect that this was happening most of the time, and emperors had to put up with it, as the ancient Roman emperors did too. So the hippodrome was a site of potential conflict. People could boo or the reverse, right? The emperor could be very popular. Maybe he just won a war. Maybe he just had an heir or something like that. So there was a management of public opinion insofar as Roman and Byzantine technologies allowed. The emperors preferred to appear in public when they suspected there would be a positive reception, and they were reluctant to face the public when it would not be positive. And this is a serious problem for the following reason. There was no right to the throne. In other words, not only was there no right to succeed to the throne, it was could not be passed through inheritance by itself. You needed this kind of popular ratification and acclamation. But even once you had the throne, so you had been acclaimed emperor, you could still be overthrown at any time. And the prelude to that would be popular disenchantment, that is grumbling, protests, these kinds of things. It seems that the populace of Constantinople was very attuned to what was going on in the palace. They ate up the gossip, probably created a lot of it. So the people of Constantinople, and also of the provinces, I believe, but this was more intense in Constantinople, were paying very close attention to imperial politics. And so if you came out into the hippodrome and for one reason or another, the people are restless and maybe they start calling out things like you are unworthy or you are a liar. So this happened to Justinian in the lead up to the Nika riots. Then you're in trouble. And it gets worse. If 200,000 or 300,000 of them take to the streets and blockade the palace, then you're in real trouble. There's almost no coming back from that. And let me say that the only person who ever survived that was Justinian. Justinian is the only Byzantine emperor who fought back with armies, killed a very large number of his own subjects, between 30 and 50,000 people in the Nika riots. This is in January of 532, and kept his throne. Now, he had to kill about a tenth of his own capital to do that. But he's the only one who ever did. In the rest of Byzantine history, if the people are against you in such numbers, you're finished. You will reach, for instance, the downfall of Michael V in 1042 and other similar events. Mm-hmm. Now, let me add one more thing, and I'll be brief. It's not the people alone who matter. In other words, you're not just thinking of the large masses of ordinary Roman citizens in Constantinople. The problem is that emperors are surrounded by rivals for the throne. And these are generals, high officials at the court, these types. You need these types in order to govern. And you need them to be able to govern well, which means they need to be capable. But the more capable they are, the more popular they get, the more of a danger they pose to you. This is actually the predicament of being an emperor, right? Because you can't do everything by yourself. You need a core group of supporters. I'd say maybe about 10 to 15 would be the inner circle. These are the men who handle most of the departments of government, your generals, your finance guys, your patriarch, those guys. Beyond that, I'd say there's a wider circle of maybe 300 to 400 other men. And these are your subordinate, your officers that are low in rank, your provincial governors, your bishops, these kinds of people. So that wider circle is your pool of potential rivals, usurpers, right? And they are watching. Some of them are very ambitious, and they're watching. And they're watching to see when you're going to be weak. And so everyone is paying attention to public opinion. And when you are perceived to be weak through the kinds of behaviors that I mentioned earlier, you're in danger. So the problem with the people is that not so much that they will do what happened in the Nika riots or in 1042, which is just rise up directly and take you down by engaging in the kinds of uprisings that we saw a few years ago in the Arab world in Egypt. I mean, you just blockade the center of government for enough time that it collapses. So that's one way to take down a regime. And the Byzantines knew this, and they practiced it. No, the bigger problem was if someone staged a coup or rebelled against you, and so there's now a potential choice between you and your rival. What happens if public opinion is so far against you that they side with him? And that's, I think, the bigger threat. So we have cases of civil war or this contestation. They're actually more like elections. They're not civil wars in the way in which we imagine civil wars, which are sort of usually about something like slavery or the abolition of a monarchy or something like that. They're almost never about anything in Byzantium other than who gets to sit on the throne. So it's like a popularity contest. It's much more like an election. So we have cases where the people of Constantinople are so outside the walls, there is the army of a rebel, and they decide to stick with the sitting emperor. And that support is usually decisive. They can man the walls, they support him, he's emboldened, he fights back. He can hold out until he can bring some loyal armies from wherever. And there are a number of cases where the people support the outsider. Now you're going to – the cases that we know best are from later centuries, and you'll get to them, especially from the 11th century. But you've already had, for instance, the case of, say, the general Leontius. So this is the general who deposed Justinian the second, the first time. And he engaged in what was actually a kind of ritual political behavior almost in Constantinople. He was apparently afraid for his life. And so what he did was is he staged a demonstration against the emperor and called the people to arms. And they came out and supported him because the emperor was unpopular. But you covered this about Justinian II, right?
Absolutely.
And that was that. He took a huge risk. He had to have had a sense that public opinion was against Justinian, because otherwise he'd have been toast. And we actually know of people who tried the same thing, but it failed. For example, in 1056, the cousin of the previous emperor, so the emperor was Constantine the Ninth Monomachos, his cousin named Theodosius, he tried exactly the same stunt. And it failed. The current emperor was not as unpopular. Theodosius himself was probably not popular. He miscalculated, and by the time he reached Hagia Sophia, he was alone and the streets were deserted. Mm. And he just sat outside of Hagia Sophia, I think alone with his son, and just, okay, now, so he has to beg for mercy. So there are a number of cases this happening. So those are calculated appeals for public support. And if they fail, you are a usurper who failed, and you are condemned as either evil, wicked, whatever, or just dumb. If you succeed, you are the next emperor crowned by God, and all of the rhetoric applies to you now.
So hopefully listeners recognize this dynamic and see that tension in the all-powerful emperor's position. And they've certainly heard, as you've described, a number of rebellions in our narrative, particularly the last two centuries, just constant attempts. So as you looked into this, what did you begin to see as the ideological justification for the emperor's position and the people's decisions on who to support should a civil war break out?
Well, that's a very good question. I couldn't make sense of this kind of behavior or the aberrant nature of the Byzantine monarchy. It was just very, very strange. In fact, it seems strange to Westerners who visited, who were just appalled at the way in which the Byzantines seemed to treat their emperors like almost having no respect for the office or whatever, and especially for disregarding their oaths of loyalty and for violating what to Western sort of quote-unquote feudal eyes were just unbreakable ties and, you know, just the absolute legitimacy that dynastic succession gave them in the West. This just didn't exist in Byzantium. So this brings us to a second strand of the argument. And this has to do specifically with what the Roman background, the Roman identity of the Byzantine Empire and of the Byzantines themselves. So this is another very contested area of research. It's contested in as to whether this is a legitimate area of research. And I think it is. I think we need to do a lot more to bring out the underlying Roman dynamics of the Byzantine political regime. So this is a project on which I've been engaged for some time. I've published some very preliminary discussions of it. So let me just outline very briefly what the different approaches that we can take to this. So one approach would be to just talk about the Byzantines' Roman identity. And this is something I intend to do, but I haven't done it in a full and documented way. What it would involve is basically this falls into a by now traditional type of scholarly investigation, where you look at what people call themselves and ask, you know, what does this mean and why do they call themselves this? And in what parts of their lives do they think this name, you know, applies? So we, you know, we use Greek and American as something different from, you know, Orthodox and Catholic, as something different from a professor of history or a man, a woman, so forth, a father. And so we have all these different identities. When the Byzantines called themselves Romans, what did they mean? That, for me, which is something that remains to be done fully, is somewhat easier to do because they call themselves Romans all the time and in all kinds of contexts, and it's sort of undeniable. What was a bit harder was to make an argument for the Roman nature of their political system. And that's what I did in the Byzantine Republic. That is, the idea, the underlying idea of the book is that that missing middle ground that shapes the political sphere, that enables the Byzantines to think and act politically, is not the imperial idea of the emperor crowned by God and so forth that we find in a number of texts, but primarily in panegyrical texts or praising the emperor once he's established. And I thought that that middle ground, let me explain it in a certain kind of way. So it's the, when we talk about the ideology of a political culture, I'm not referring to just any kind of statement that anybody can make, like the kinds of praises of the emperor that we find in panegyrical texts, like the emperor has chosen you because you were the best one, and we now all owe you obedience, and anyone who disobeys you is a criminal and unchristian and a monster and so forth. Rather, ideology is something that even we ourselves, in our own lives, don't really see that clearly. We don't talk about it that much because it's the sort of thing that we take for granted. These are the sorts of things that make intuitive sense to us, that facilitate our acts of political reasoning, right? So when you say, well, I support this policy because it just kind of makes sense, you're relying on certain fundamental assumptions about fairness, about justice, and so on, that you hope, well, you actually tend to assume everybody shares. So in modern America, a large part of the population has absorbed the idea that hard work by itself leads to success. And therefore that failure, or put bluntly, poverty, is somehow your fault. And that's an ideology. It's very rarely ever articulated in those terms, right? And it takes a lot of work to get, say, students to understand the mechanisms of privilege, of the unequal distribution of opportunity, the way in which systems are structured to, you know, that it is not in accordance with that ideology. And so you have to kind of bring that assumption out. They're not ready with it. So I got to thinking about Byzantium this way, and it seemed to me, so one thing that everyone is taking for granted that yet nobody is really talking openly about, at least not in explicit terms. There are some places where they talk about it, but they're kind of cagey, is the idea that emperors can be delegitimated if they act in certain ways, and specifically, if enough of the populace finds them to be unacceptable or unsuited for office even after many years of being in office. And if the populace expresses that discontent in a substantial or loud enough way, that by itself disqualifies, it makes the emperor into a non-emperor. They can de-acclaim an emperor by reversing the chance that they use when they acclaim him. So the idea that the Roman populace in large enough numbers, that their collective behavior can constitute the grounds on which a man is made an emperor, but also unmade, that pointed me in the direction of the Roman background and the Roman shape of the political sphere. Because after all, the Byzantine Empire, right, as I'm sure your audience is aware by now, is just a continuation of the Roman Empire. There's no date at which we can say, here it shifts. It's the same political culture. The institutions have a continuous history. I mean, it changes. Everything changes all the time, but there's no point of rupture. And so if you trace this all the way back, I realize that the matrix of imperial politics is actually much, much older, and it goes back to the late Republic. So these ideas about popular consent and the legitimacy of office holders as reflecting a kind of universal consent of the people they govern is a deeply rooted idea in the Roman tradition, whether that is in Latin or in Greek. And that's where I found my middle ground. It's actually pervasive in Byzantine texts. It's just that nobody had paid attention to it for a number of reasons. The first reason is that no one was looking. The second reason is that the word in question is potentially, it's tricky, it's potentially confusing. So the word in question is politeia. Politeia in English, politeia in Greek. And it's pervasive in Byzantine texts. They're always talking about this thing. And the problem is that it's very difficult to translate. And in many translations, it's rendered as the state, which is not exactly what it is. I mean, it includes the state, but it's not that. There are many places where that doesn't make any sense at all. So, for example, if an author is itemizing the elements of the politeia and he includes merchants and priests and farmers and soldiers and tax collectors, well, that's not the state unless you have a Soviet, understanding of the state, and they didn't. So there are many things like that. Or when someone says that an emperor, funded higher education and the arts, and this adorned the politeia with, the majesty of letters and reason and beauty. And you're like, really? I mean, the state? Is that? But he doesn't mean that. So I got to working on this term, and what I discovered in tracing its genealogy, its contours, its shape, is that in fact this term, which is pervasive in Byzantine texts, especially historical and political texts, is simply the Greek translation of res publica, the old Latin where we get the word republic, and that you could actually even trace the process by which the Latin term res publica came to sort of colonize the meaning of the Greek term politeia. A good place where your audience can go if they really want to delve into the philology of it are the novels issued by Justinian the First. So we have 140 some whatever the full text of these novels, and it's so fortunate that we have the Latin and the Greek versions in parallel columns. Now you'll need a magnifying glass to read them in the 19th century edition, and you also need the ability to read Greek and Latin. But you can actually see that where the Latin says res publica, the Greek says politeia. This was a process that was completed already by that time. Anyway, so what does that mean? Why is that important? Well, it's important because in Latin, respublica does not mean a republic. That is a modern, so our modern term republic is modern. By now, it means something like a non-monarchical regime with a certain level of shared governance, at least among the elites, and with a measure of popular participation and or representation. That's not what it means in ancient Latin, just as a philological point, right? So this is potentially confusing. So we refer to the Roman Republic as being something different from the empire. That doesn't make sense in Latin, not at all, right? So if you think about it, the Roman, what we call Republic, had an empire before it had an emperor. And conversely, later, what we call the Roman Empire is referred to consistently by its authors as a res publica. So something's clearly off here, right, between the ancient terminology and the modern terminology. But to make a long story short, in Latin, res publica, it does not refer to a specific type of regime. That's how we think of it, right? Like how the offices are structured, especially without a king. But rather, a res publica refers to the common interests and the common property, in fact, of a people who are constituted as a people by having the same kinds of laws, customs, understandings about morality, and the sense that they do form a political community which can authorize the use of power. Now, authorizing the use of power is what I use in the book, does not necessarily mean having access to organs to governmentality. In other words, that the people are directly participating in the government. This is, yes, I mean, from my personal politics, that's preferable. But in the Roman tradition, this is not necessarily what it meant. It came to mean, especially under the empire, a regime in which the government, if you will, is beholden to its constituents, the shareholders, the Roman people. And this is what makes Roman and Byzantine government so responsive to its people to a certain degree. But that's not so much the theme that I pursue in the book. What I pursue is how it's constituted and vulnerable to its population. And this is actually what explains this very turbulent political history, which nevertheless does not affect the shape of the regime, the monarchy itself. And so it's that underlying assumption that the emperors are beholden to their people, and that when they cease to be popular in certain ways, they can be deauthorized, and the people can put in whomever they want and do so. So that's sort of that assumption runs fairly deeply in Byzantium. It's funny thing, though, isn't it? I mean, in a sense that Byzantium, which we have so long associated with, you know, absolutist monarchy and all this stuff, it turns out to actually be more republican in this sense than, say, the later Roman Empire, which you covered in the earlier. Well, you came in at the sort of tail end of that, right? So when emperors are ruling through armies, the people of the populace of the cities or whatever cities the emperors are in have far less ability to show their displeasure. Whereas once the emperors settle down in Constantinople, there's this far closer dialectical relationship that emerges. And you've kind of traced the history of this in the 5th century. It was coming back to the 5th century.
But what I really want to draw this out for the listener and go all the way back to Augustus's role in this, because it's one of the things in the book that you point out that we are so influenced, particularly the casual history reader, by this designation of the Republic followed by the Empire, and that we therefore think, you know, when we read the word Republic, the idea of modern republics is sort of imprinted indelibly on us. And so, correct me if I'm wrong, you're suggesting here that when the power moves from the elected officers and the consuls into the hands of the emperor, the people don't necessarily think, well, it was nice when we had freedom, but now, you know, we are just run by a dictator.
Right.
It was more nuanced to them that even though there was now only one officer who held the ultimate power, life hadn't changed in the sense that he could do what he likes. The same responsibilities and the same responsiveness they'd expected before remained in public life. And that, by the time we get to Byzantium, transferred to this sense of, okay, I can't vote for a different consul, but I can vote, in inverted commas, for a new emperor. I can support someone else who will be more responsive to my needs. And I think that will blow a lot of people's minds as an idea, because we're so fixed on the idea that an emperor represents autocracy and a republic represents democratic freedom, when actually that's a very modern, those are modern concepts we're putting back on the past for a state that, as you say, continues, you know, with people's lives not changing nearly as dramatically as we might think when you look at it in terms of republic versus empire.
Oh, absolutely. And let's not forget why the emperors came to be at all, right? In other words, the emperors, let's say Caesar or Augustus, they didn't, the history of their lives and their political careers was not them usurping power from the people and in some, you know, some way that a more or less violent way, but not actually, it was very much the opposite. Caesar and Augustus came to power largely through popular support because enough people were persuaded that they would protect the Res Publica better than their opponents. But certainly the late Republican aristocratic class, which had by that point, so the last Senate lost its legitimacy. So the Senate had, Caesar and Augustus, and particularly Caesar, were voted, right? They were given these powers by votes, by popular assemblies, precisely so that they could put down this plutocratic, oppressive gang of warlords and sort of financiers who had been oppressing the majority of Romans for so many decades. And the system of giving the emperors their rights, their powers by law, this persisted for 3 centuries. In other words, we know that as late as the 3rd century, the early 3rd century, when emperors were made, there was a set of laws that were passed by the Senate and the people, which authorized them to act in that capacity. The leges de imperio, and we have fragments of some of them. So it was actually the people who backed Caesar in the initial move here. And you're exactly right. The Roman people always thereafter expected the emperors to behave, to rule in a manner that promoted the welfare, and that usually meant the material welfare, but later spiritual and doctrinal considerations came into play of the Roman people. So the type of regime, so we've become fixated on the type of regime. The Roman tradition itself is not so fixated. So, for instance, if you read Cicero, this is before Augustus, his treatise on De Republica, on the Republic, you can see very clearly he doesn't think that a republic is a particular type of regime, but rather this other more abstract concept of a people constituted in a particular way. And he goes through the different types of regimes that can govern a republic. A democracy, a monarchy, an oligarchy. He considers them all as viable for a republic. It's just that he prefers what he calls the sort of mixed thing. And anyway, for him, it was primarily the Senate. So it was sort of ruled by the Senate, where the other elements either follow along and give it legitimacy in this kind of dialectical relationship. If you actually replace everything that Cicero says about the Senate and you just put the word emperor in there, it's a pretty good description of the empire later on. But by the way, this tradition of republican thought continued on down to the 18th century. So if you read Rousseau and the Social Contract, this is a republican theory, the theory of republican governance, he also is kind of theoretically neutral among the different types of regimes. And he has actually a very interesting analysis, which I used explicitly in the book, which was also ironically because Rousseau thought that Byzantium was all, you know, all the awful things that Enlightenment thinkers thought Byzantium was, you know, sort of superstitious and theocratic and absolutist and all that. But actually his description of a monarchical republic is perfect for Byzantium, especially when he's talking about reallocations of power through violence. He doesn't put it that way, but you know that really is what must happen. So think about it in these terms, and this is actually very contemporary. This is very, very, very relevant, because when you have a regime where the apparatus of government is entirely in the hands of, say, in Byzantium, one person and his inner circle and then his wider circle, but at any rate, a more or less restricted kind of oligarchy, even if, of course, its members are constantly being replenished from below. But anyway, if the people who constitute a kind of ideological support for the regime, or at any rate, believe themselves to be its stakeholders, have no access to the apparatus of government as such. So they cannot claim as people to have these assemblies, right, which act according to some kind of constitution in this way in relation to the other mechanisms of government. They have none. Well, that poses a very interesting problem, right? What happens when the sort of ideological sovereign, the people, and the governmental sovereign, the emperor and his entire apparatus, conflict? Now, look, for instance, at what's been happening in the world, like in the past 10 years, right? I mean, it's crazy, right? So in all of these countries, and I mean, Egypt is a very striking example, but it's not limited to Egypt. So Egypt is, in theory, a republic. If you read its constitution, it's a republic in which the people are sovereign. What access to mechanisms of government do they have? And for that matter, what access to mechanisms of government do any of us have in the US or in Europe, right? So you'll say elections, primarily elections. Beyond that, whoever gets into politics successfully, normally that's an elite, more or less. In the U.S., I think all members of Congress are millionaires, and I think some of them are multimillionaires. And the rate at which incumbents are returned to office is somewhere in the 90s%. So yeah, that's an oligarchy and it's a plutocracy. What access does the ideological or legal sovereign have? Well, not much. So in Byzantium, it was none. I'm not entirely sure that we have that much more. In Egypt, de facto, it was none. In other words, for the actual sovereign, not the actual sovereign, I don't want to take sides in that, but the theoretical, the ideological sovereign to take action ultimately means violence, because the government is against you, or you're against the government. So what happens when you're against the government? And so your audience will have, if your audience is listening to podcasts about Byzantium, they are presumably people who are paying attention to what's going on in the world as well. And they will know that everywhere from England to France to Greece, right, to Egypt, and even in the U.S., I mean, the Occupy movement, to a degree, these countries are all experiencing a kind of crisis in the legitimacy of the institutions of government when enough people believe that they are acting against their own interests. And when that happens, regimes are in trouble. This happened in Byzantium frequently, but here's what it takes. It takes, and this was shown very clearly in Egypt, enough people to blockade the center of government power as to effectively bring it to its knees. This almost happened in Iran during the same period, right? And it, mm-hmm. you know, efforts were made in Greece and Spain, though they were not, they were probably not massive enough, which probably reflects on a divided electorate. But when it is massive enough, it's devastating for a regime. I mean, how long can it last? And if the regime is tyrannical, that is, if it uses force to suppress the expression of subjects' discontent, it can make things a lot worse, right? So I can imagine that Mubarak, like any Byzantine emperor besieged in the palace, was thinking, do I unleash the troops or not? Mm-hmm. Right? This is what Justinian was thinking. Because if that backfires, you're finished. If this just simply aggravates them more or brings more people over to their side, you're finished, like the Shah of Iran discovered. So I think that even our own governments should pay closer attention to, and I think they do, to discontent, because they can only take it so far before the rope gets stretched too tightly, right? Mm. And Byzantium is just a laboratory of these. If only we knew exactly what set them off. It's very opaque because our writers, our historians, they're all from the aristocracy.
Yeah.
But let me go back to the 5th century. I was going to conclude with this one point and bring it back to what I think happened then. Because I don't want to suggest that the people and the emperors are always at odds, right? That doesn't always happen. In fact, most of the time, it doesn't. It's not the people are usually supportive of the regime, and there's no sense in which the people want to impose some kind of republican ideology as opposed to the much more theocratic rhetoric used by the court. No, it's not like that at all. The people, the Byzantines definitely wanted to think of their emperor as being God's chosen and so forth. They wanted that. This was their emperor. After all, they had chosen him and acclaimed him. And I don't think they were being cynical or insincere when they did that. And there were times when I think the monarchy and the people acted together. And This is an unexplored sort of area of research. I've only begun to think about it, and I haven't written about it yet, so you're getting it first. So in part, how did the Eastern Empire survive in the 5th century when the West didn't? And obviously, you know, a lot has been written about this. Many factors have been identified correctly. The East, by the way, was learning from the failures or disasters that struck the West, especially when it came to things like building walls and so forth. Alaric sacks Rome, Constantinople gets a new set of walls. The Vandals sack Rome, Constantinople gets some seawalls. Okay. So one other thing that happened during the 5th century was that the emperors stopped moving around with their armies, but this at the end of the 4th century, and settled down in Constantinople. But another thing also happens. In the West, imperial power becomes beholden to basically one warlord at a time. And there's this one guy who's running the armies. He's either a Roman general or half Roman, half barbarian, but fully Romanized, and he's in control of the armies. And that man's decisions are sort of all important for the fate of the empire, but also for the emperor himself. And we have some of these kingmakers, you know, deposing or executing their emperors, putting another one in place, and so forth. But this doesn't happen in the East. And in part, it doesn't happen because the civilian aristocracy, the court, managed to successfully tame or control its armies, especially the kind of barbarian armies. And they did this in a number of ways. They divided the command. The commands remained divided, so you had five top generals, not one. They played them off against each other. But I think another thing that happened was a kind of alliance, if you will, between the people of Constantinople and the political authorities to keep political power in the city, at the court, and not in the hands of these, you know, Roman or Romanized generals. You actually have an instance where the people of Constantinople rise up. This is in 399, and the events of 399, 400, where they literally rise up and slaughter this Gothic army in Constantinople. The remnants of the Goths scatter, and the emperors use other generals to put them down, and so on. Then there's another case, the emperor Leo I, he has a barbarian general who's trying to control him behind the scenes. And he invites him to the palace and slaughters him and his entire family. So it's the opposite of what's going on in the West. And I think that in a number of ways, the regime, the imperial regime in Constantinople shifted and sought its support more from the people in Constantinople and less exclusively from the armies. Now, obviously, you want the armies always, right? But that's how I think you get this transition from those battlefield acclamations that you have in Ammianus to the very civilian acclamations that you have in 491 with Anastasius.
Do you think the physical geography of Constantinople plays a part in that? That it is difficult for an army to get in or out, that is, this fortress allows the people to have perhaps more of a say than they might in a city situated elsewhere.
That's a good idea. That's interesting. I mean, I think that needs to be pursued more. What came to my mind when I first heard what you were getting at, was actually how close the Hippodrome is to the palace.
Yes.
Now, the Hippodrome is close to the palace in Rome, too. And that's why it was made the way it was made. But I think that that proximity sort of stands for the very close relationship that the palace sought with the people. The Hippodrome is the place where the largest number of people can assemble. And it's right next to the palace because the emperors wanted to have access to their audience as you know, on their terms. And they tried to orchestrate and manipulate it as much as they could, of course. But I think that the conjunction of those two sort of represents the type of regime that evolved in Constantinople. But you're right. Both of them are also as far from the kind of Thracian hinterland as you can get. Mm. And so an enemy army would have to go through quite a bit of city. I wonder if they were thinking about this, because it never actually happened, at least not until 1453. Even when the Crusaders took the city, it was from a different direction. Constantinople being surrounded by the sea also meant that it couldn't be surrounded by armies. As a rebel, you'd have to control both the fleet and the army to do it damage. But think about Rome was vulnerable because you could have lots of armies camped around it.
Yeah. I mean, it's just interesting because the period, the crisis of the third century when armies begin acclaiming people sort of can't happen when you have fortress Constantinople as the center of government. But those armies have to put themselves through extreme sieges if they want to change the government and the people are supporting the government.
I see. That's a very good point. In other words, the physical infrastructure of the city acts as a kind of buffer between the emperor, who's lodged as far out on the peninsula as possible, and any possible armies.
So his relationship with the people of the capital is even more important to him, because as you already said, if they're with him, his position is much stronger if there's a rebel out in the field.
That's a very good point. Yeah, no, I think we need to study this a lot more. The creation of a Constantinopolitan regime. Yeah.
And you have another book that you're working on connected to the Byzantine Republic.
No, yes. I have been collecting notes and thoughts for that for some time. I'd say probably 9 years by now. It was the book I thought I would write first, but then I started thinking more about politics than identity. But this is the book on identity. So it will be my argument for what the Byzantines meant when they said they were Romans. How did they understand it, and what models can we use to understand that? Because changes in that understanding affect, you know, all the vocabulary that we use in talking about Byzantium. And I mean things like empire or, you know, multi-ethnic empire. Are these appropriate terms? Theocracy and medieval Hellenism and all of these evasions that we have to get away from the actual Byzantine terminology, literally translated, what they keep saying is the Republic of the Romans. So I've talked a little bit about, so my book is about the first part of that equation. What do they mean by republic, and where do we see it in their history? And the second one is going to be about the second part of that equation. Who are these Romans? But that's a topic for a different discussion.
Yes. Well, it sounds like we may have to have you back on to talk about that. Okay. And I know a lot of listeners are very passionate about telling people, you know, that this is still the Roman Empire. It's called the History of Byzantium purely for classification in iTunes. I also gather you're working on a narrative history of mid-10th to end of the 11th century, which I imagine is a lot of work. But I think a lot of listeners would be excited to read when we get to that period.
Yes, that's right. I decided to go back to the sources. This is a period, it's a fascinating and very, very exciting and crucial period of Byzantine history. I've worked on many of the sources in it, so the historians, Ataliates, Psellos, and so on. And I realized that much of my work on these authors has made it more difficult to use them as sources because they are, you know, very deliberate sort of literary, artists and very politicized, and we can't take them at face value. And so I thought I would put myself in on the other side of the equation and see, well, what is it that we can do? But anyway, so I wanted to go back to the sources because this is a period that hasn't been narrated and investigated in this way since the 19th century. Everything that we have since then rests on that work by Schlumberger. And I thought I would go back and see what it looks like now, not starting from all the modern narratives that we have about it, but looking at what the sources say. And that was a very interesting exercise. Oddly enough, I'd never actually written narrative history before, but it was a lot of fun. And at the moment, I'm still struggling with the First Crusade.
Yeah, as I can imagine. But that sounds fantastic. And there are not enough modern narrative histories of the Byzantine period for my liking. And that's obviously what the listeners are often looking for. So that's very exciting. And I think we should probably say we're going to wrap things up there and encourage people to go and read the Byzantine Republic for themselves and find out more.
Thank you, Robin. It was a real pleasure to be here. I confess I haven't done this before, but I'm getting a taste for it. So let me know if I can be of use for your project, which, again, I want to congratulate you and thank you for. We should be doing more of this ourselves, but in different media, since you have this well covered.
Thanks again for coming on.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. I was blown away by some of the ideas that Professor Cordelis put forward, and so I'm going to discuss them a little further in our next episode and tell you a bit more about the book. But as I said at the start, do buy it for yourself if you'd like to know more. You can also find out more about Professor Cordelis' other work at cordelispublications.weebly.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.